My name is Claire Kilpatrick from the World Health Organization, and I'm here to welcome you all to today's WHO-free Weber teleclass on patient participation and involvement. This topic is very, very close to the heart of the work that WHO wants to support and is proud to work in collaboration with other experts around the globe, and that includes the two speakers for this evening. Sorry, I keep saying this evening because, of course, I'm based in the UK, but welcome to everyone in other parts of the globe, including in America, where obviously it's good afternoon for all of you. And I'd like to introduce now Marianne McGuckin, as you can see from the slide, from McGuckin Methods International. Marianne is an inspiration and really does challenge us all to think about patient participation and promotion and improvement for hand hygiene. She's been working in this field for many years, and we've been proud to work with her and collaborate with her from WHO. One of her recent publications, the book on patient safety, is truly inspirational, and it really is worth a read for everyone's perspective. We've also got another excellent speaker presenting with us, and this debate will be very interesting, or the slides presented by both speakers on the pros and cons of this challenging topic. And that's Dr. Yves Longtan, who again I've had the great privilege to work with when in Geneva and working closely with him on patient participation projects and the number of publications that he has issued on that topic. He's definitely an expert in that field. And last year I was proud to present a very similar presentation with him in Europe on this topic, where we really enjoy challenging each other on how we can truly make patients part of hand hygiene improvement. I don't think we've quite got the answer yet, so I think today we'll be challenged to hear how it can work and what still we need to resolve around the topic. And now I'm going to hand over to Marianne. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire, and I'd like to welcome everyone who signed in for this teleconference. It's very exciting to be able to present this topic. And I just want to begin by saying I don't want our participants to feel that at the end of this conference they're going to have to make a decision on whether they are for or against patient empowerment. I think patient empowerment and participation is here to stay, and we just would like to bring to you some of the pros and cons in terms of setting up your program. If you go to our first slide, a little bit of terminology. I believe, and I think because I am in the U.S., we more frequently use the term patient empowerment. And for me, patient empowerment is the umbrella term, the basic term in terms of getting patients involved. I believe that you need to empower the patients first in order for them to participate or be involved or be engaged. But the terms that you use will depend on where you are in the country you're from, the culture of that country, and the institution. On this slide, there are two words that I want you to keep in mind as we proceed through this presentation, and the two words are explicit permission. And I think by the end of this presentation, you will get a good feel for what this is about. Some abbreviations that you'll see through this PowerPoint so that when you go back over this, you will be able to relate to this. The overview that we intend to accomplish or present during this presentation is basically what is empowerment, and we will talk about hand hygiene and empowerment in three phases, 1982, then the second phase, 1997 to 2007, and 2007 to 2013. I'm going to begin by talking about the pros, giving you what I believe is some evidence and some implementations in order to get you going on patient empowerment. If we now turn to slide number 5, let's define patient empowerment as we did with the World Health Organization guidelines. It's a process in which patients understand their role. That's very important as we proceed through this presentation. They are given the knowledge and skills by their healthcare worker, and that's where explicit permission is going to come in, to provide a to perform a task in an environment that recognizes community and cultural differences and encourages patient participation. This is a definition that you should keep in mind and frequently use when you're trying to explain this program to other people in your institution. I'd like to believe, and I want to also say that maybe I started in this field very young, but I'd like to say that I think I was basically a pioneer in 1982 when I came, when I brought the idea of the journey of empowerment to the surface. And it happened at that time I was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, and we had started, or I had started a master's PhD program to train people in infection control. It was the only program in the United States, so we were interviewed by many people. And one interviewer from the Medical World News and Report asked me to say in one sentence what I thought was very important in infection control. And this is a sentence that I came up with, and it was based on the fact that prior to that, I had actually done infection control for several years. So I was one of those worker bees on the front line that did infection control on a daily basis and would go month after month to the infection control meetings, and we would see problems and data, but it never really, I never felt that there was a real good decrease in infection rates. And with that in mind, we came to this quote that patients should be sure that any physician, nurse, therapist has washed their hands before touching them. And the editor of this journal drew this little cartoon, and it always stayed in my mind. However, if we go to slide number 7, it took me probably 15 years to try to find somebody who would have some funding in order to test this model of patient empowerment. And with that, we developed, and I think some of you may be familiar with this program, Partners in Your Care. And we began this program in 1997. And it was a very simple program where we just encouraged patients to ask their healthcare worker, did you wash your hands? The next slide, slide 8. If we look at the program in general, and whether it's Partners in Your Care or whatever program you're using, I believe that any patient empowerment model needs to have 3 or 4 components. The first thing, some type of educational brochure that is given to patients, some type of visual reminder, and there has to be an outcome measured. And however you measure this outcome, we chose to measure hand hygiene compliance per bed day, and then also a patient survey. The fourth part of it was feedback to the staff. And at the time that we started this model, we really didn't have a good handle on the idea that healthcare workers really also had to be empowered. If we go to slide number 9, these are the materials that we used when we started our program. And this was back in 1997. It was a very simple brochure that told people the who, where, why, and when of hand hygiene. Very simple, and I encourage people who are starting their programs to keep your materials simple. The key thing is that patients need to get this information within 24 hours of being admitted. Slide number 10, these are some of the visual reminders that we used in our program, and there's a whole slew of these that can be used, and some sites are actually giving out personalized hand sanitizers. So this is, you know, in your realm to choose whatever type of visual reminder that you'd like to use. I discourage people from using posters. I think they are not effective in many situations. Slide number 11. Once we had our model in place and we had tested it in 1997 in 4 hospitals in 2 states, we then began to realize that we needed more data in order to really look at this model even more closely. So between 1997 and 2006, you can see how many places we actually took this model and implemented it. It was a standardized model. Hospitals who chose to use this model, what we did was we went into these hospitals and we looked at their hand hygiene compliance rate per bed day, and we let them keep whatever program they were doing. And I say that because you realize prior to 2006, we did not have all of the guidelines that we have now that WHO has sponsored on their first global challenge. So we went into the hospitals and we evaluated what they were doing, and we came out with a hand hygiene compliance rate pre-intervention. And I want to emphasize that the way in which we measured this was not just product consumption, in that we said that they used 3 liters of sanitizer or 2 liters of soap. What we did was actually develop a model using 24 different variables so that the end outcome that we measured was the number of times hand hygiene occurred when there was a patient in the bed. So that's key to remember. So you can see in all the different places that we have been in the UK, Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, and then we came back to the U.S. and we looked at the program in rehabilitation. The reason we did that, we wanted to test the idea that in a rehabilitation center, patients are really dependent on their healthcare worker, and we wanted to see in this population, would they be willing to ask them? We then tested it in long-term care, and then finally in the ICU, because one of the comments that we had gotten from some people is, how do you empower people in an intensive care unit? And what we did was a very novel idea. We basically had people who are working in the intensive care unit, specifically the medical director, the nurse manager, and the ICP, to record a series of 10 messages, like don't forget to wash your hands, sanitize your hands, gloves do not replace hand washing, remember hand washing before and after patient care. And we actually just had a simple recorder at the nurse's station randomly playing these messages every 15 seconds. The interesting thing is we told all the healthcare workers that they could turn off these messages whenever they chose, and in fact, we were surprised to find out that they didn't. And the main driving force why they didn't was basically their medical director, or we can say their employer or their boss, were the ones who made the messages. And in fact, you know, they were not going to challenge this. Also, it was in an environment where the medical director just liked having these voices played. So we got very good results using that, and it's a very simple thing that you can do in your own institutions, and we did significantly increase our hand hygiene sanitizer usage. If you look at the impact of the evaluations on the right-hand side in the green box, you'll see that by and large we were able to increase hand hygiene per bed day somewhere in the ballpark of 40 to 55%. Now, the interesting thing is it's often noted that, well, we had such a significant increase because we started at low compliance. If you recall, in 1997, hand hygiene compliance across, whether it's in the U.S. or abroad, was probably less than 50%, and more realistically, like 30. So, you know, to say that because it was a low number, it isn't a good outcome is probably not correct, because we saw a significant increase, and people who started at higher percentages also had the same type of increase. If we go to slide 12, you'll see that in the U.S., there are just about most of our states covered that have some form of patient empowerment and are using some form of this program that we developed. We also took this program abroad. And in the UK, on the right-hand side, that's Julie's Store, which some of you are familiar with. And down at the bottom, we're really excited because there are a group of 10 to 12 hospitals in Hungary that are using the models that we developed. On the left-hand side, I just show you a picture of how myself and our colleagues in our company actually go out and educate people and go to the front line and show them, you know, how do you develop these empowerment programs. If we go to slide number 14, the empowerment model that I'll be discussing when I come back after Yves gives his presentation involves six simple steps. And I trust that after this presentation and by the May 5th Global Challenge on Involving Patient Participation, people listening to this presentation should be able to get to at least step three so that you have some involvement of your patients. Slide number 15, if we put together everything that I've said so far, the top dark blue line represents 1997 when we really began the evaluation through 2006 when we were testing this model of empowerment and how we were going to measure it and what effect it had. The bottom dark blue line from 2007 to the present day, well, you can say May 2013, are all the different regulatory bodies that came on board to embrace the idea of patient participation. I often say that it took them a while to catch up with something that I thought about many years before that, but we now have the World Health Organization, Joint Commission, CDC, our National Patient Safety Foundation, who are all embracing the idea of patient empowerment. slide number 16, there's always the issue of, you know, people might be willing to have good intentions of doing something or willing to do it, and will they really do it? But if we look at the idea of willingness, patients want empowerment. I think the key study began was in 1989 when doctors Miller and Farr in Virginia actually surveyed patients, inpatients, and they asked them questions about, you know, did you feel that you got some information about hospital-acquired infections? And the results that they found that most patients were dissatisfied with the information that they received. And in fact, they then asked them, would they be willing to pay some extra money each day in order to get this information? And they did. So about 57% said they were willing to do this. From 1999 to 2005, we found in all our studies that about 70% of our patients are willing to do this. There was a study in England and Wales in the Clean Your Hand campaigns, and they found similar results to ours, and that 71% were willing to be empowered. And then in 2006, we did a telephone survey, and we added the simple dimension in our survey when we surveyed people across the U.S. We said, if your healthcare worker gave you explicit permission that it was okay to ask them about this, would you be willing to do it? And the percentages went up to 80%. Now, I want you to look at these three circles and keep in mind the number somewhere between 60 and 70%. And the reason I say that is that's probably what is going to happen when you start these programs. And it basically goes along with what we all refer to, what we all know about, which is the bell curve. If you look at think about the bell curve where you have a hump in the middle, if you take the two highest points in that hump, that represents about 68%. So by and large, when you start a program like this, you want to go after that 68%, and you're going to be able to attain that. The other two sides of the bell curve, they're going to fall in gradually, but you need to realize that there will always be people on either end of the bell curve that are not going to buy into this, whether they be patients or healthcare workers. But we need to realize that we have to address the 60% that are willing to do this and are able to do this, and we have to give them the tools to do it. If we go to slide number 17, explicit permission means one-on-one. It doesn't mean having a brochure somewhere or a video. It means actually going in to each patient, and I will tell you when we come back to the tips at the end how this can be done in a very easy way. So you have to invite them, give them specifics, you know, direct them that it is okay to do this. Slide number 18. The research that we know so far about healthcare worker explicit permission, we do know that if you add the dimension of if your healthcare worker asked you to do this, would you do it? We know that in a couple of studies, specifically if you look at the World Health Organization survey that we did, the one highlighted in red, the percentage went from 50% who said they would ask to 86% when we added in the dimension of giving them explicit permission. There's a study done in Switzerland, and the same significant results. It went from 33 to 81. And in our U.S. survey, we found, as I noted before, 80%. If we go to slide number 19, Dr. Bate and his team actually looked at different interventions or visual type reminders that you could give healthcare workers in order to emphasize explicit permission. And the ones that we have circled, it comes down to the fact that giving patients a small bottle of hand sanitizer or hand rub, healthcare workers wearing an apron that's saying it's okay to ask, volunteers explaining it's okay to ask, and healthcare workers explaining it's okay to ask. All of these things add up to explicit permission. They are the driving force behind your program when you start it. The other visual reminders, you know, it just may in fact be a cultural thing. You know, some people just don't see those things as visual reminders. But keep in mind, if you have an individual doing this or something that gives the healthcare worker permission, they will do it. Slide number 20, let's get back to our definition. And the definition that we say patient empowerment implies to the healthcare worker. we now know that unless you empower your healthcare workers, they are not going to be able to empower their patients. So we now know it is a team effect. So using the same definition, you have to give the same skills to your healthcare workers: knowledge, understanding, and a friendly environment. Slide number 21 just overemphasizes that it has to be a team approach. Obviously, you're not going to have this many people going into each patient, but it has to be a one-on-one. It has to be active. It can't be passive, and it has to be ongoing. Slide number 22. I share this with you because in the end of 2012, I published a book on the Patient Survival Guide, 8 Simple Steps to Prevent Healthcare-Associated Infections. And I share this with you because one of the things that I did in putting this book together is actually interview hundreds of patients who had gotten hospital-acquired infections. And the interesting thing, when they were telling me this story, the driving force that makes me believe that, you know, we need to involve patients more and more every day is that at the end of their story, the phrase that kept coming back from each person was, "If only I knew." And that's what we're talking about when we talk about empowerment. We want to empower patients with the knowledge so that they don't say, "If only I knew." Because we do know that when people get hospital-acquired infections, they become true advocates. So we need to realize that if we empower our consumers are the patients of the future. So, and we also know that the next big changes in healthcare are going to be driven by the consumers. They're going to be driving us to get more information. As you know, in the U.S., 34 states right now have public and reporting and disclosure of healthcare-associated infections. We need to make this information popular in a sense that they can understand it and know what to do. And we can do the same thing in our healthcare systems. If we go to slide number 23. This is a little cartoon. I must be growing up. I've caught myself washing my hands without being told. It's a behavioral change. I know when we started the study and I was out there on the front lines educating the patients about this, I would quickly observe that within a couple weeks, often many healthcare workers would say to their patients, "Is there something you need to ask me?" And, you know, this brings home the idea that it is a learned behavior. And of interest is the fact that just a few days ago, I had turned on one of our local stations here, an educational station, and they happened to be giving a talk on Alzheimer's and dementia patients. And I'm certainly not equating our healthcare system with that. But the interesting point that they made is that with Alzheimer's and dementia patients, if you give them good, clear, concise information, they can make decisions and they can act on it. You know, so we need to keep that in mind when we think about our patients. They also made the point that if you are familiar with elderly people in assisted living, when they are assigned to a table at a dining facility to eat, they identify their seat, and after a few weeks, that's the seat they always go to, and no one is going to take that seat. So we need to say, okay, these are two factors that we can teach both our healthcare worker and our patients about, that this is something they can learn and they can do. Slide number 24 is going to be a great resource for you when you start to put your program together. We've identified the best articles that are going to give you support for working on patient empowerment. Slide number 25, basically, you know, what I've tried to do now is say, what are some of the pros? You know, we've taken this concept in 1982, we've gone through different stages, we evaluated it, there's a lot that still has to be done, and again, there will always be some people that are willing to do this, and there will always be barriers, and we have to keep working with the willingness to move this forward, and at the same time address the barriers. Eve will now talk about some of the cons of patient empowerment and, you know, how together we can work to make this move. And then I will come back at the end to give you some hints on how you can start this program so that on May 5th we can increase the percentage of people who are using empowerment. As we know right now, according to the last newsletter from World Health Organization, there's only about 26% of people are incorporating patients into their programs. Thank you. And Eve, you know, I'll open it up to you now.
Thank you, Marianne. Good afternoon, everyone. Good evening, everyone in Europe. My name is Yves Longtemps. I've already been presented. So my role is to present the more difficult downside to patient empowerment, patient participation. You can go to slide 26. So I decided to focus the downside, modify it a little bit, and say that actually, no, we cannot say that patient participation works yet. We cannot say yet that this works. So slide 27. First, I'd like to make a few disclosures. I'd like to disclose that personally, I endorse patient participation to improve hand hygiene. I was just given the tough role of being the devil's advocate for the purpose of this presentation. So slide 28, just a brief introduction regarding patient participation to prevent medical errors at large. Slide 21, there are more and more endeavors now in which we're trying to involve patients to participate to prevent medical errors. Slide 30, just to name a few initiatives, now patients are being involved, for example, to diminish, to prevent catheter-related infections, or to prevent wrong-side surgery. For example, they're invited to write on the limb they have to be operated on to prevent the fact that the surgeon would operate on the wrong limb. Patients are also being involved more and more to prevent medication errors and to detect and report surgical site infections. Slide 31. All these endeavors have shown variable degrees of success, and one of the main limitations is the lack of medical knowledge to detect errors. For example, for the one in which patients were involved in the detection and reporting of surgical site infections, there was a low accuracy. Patients tended to be anxious about the surgical wound, and they tended to over-report, over-call the infections. As soon as it was a little bit red, they thought it was infected. So this is the main limitation that probably also applies to hand hygiene. They need to know when hand hygiene should be performed in order to intervene at the right moment. Slide 32. So let's focus now a bit more on their role in the promotion of hand hygiene. Slide 33. As Marianne said, many countries now are now promoting the involvement of patients to improve hand hygiene. The United States is just one of them. Slide 34. That there is now a Speak Up campaign that was set up by the Joint Commission. In the United States, this is the accreditation organization that accredits the hospitals. And on slide 35, you can see the different components of the Speak Up campaign. And you can see on number 2 that they are encouraging patients to make sure that healthcare providers clean their hands and wear gloves. So this is well underway and by very serious organizations such as the Joint Commission. Slide 36. However, my position today is that there are many questions that remain to be answered regarding the efficacy of these programs, the level of acceptance from patients, from healthcare workers as well, and also the impact on patient healthcare worker relationship. Slide 37. So let's focus first on the efficacy of those programs. Slide 38. The main question is, are these programs associated with improvement in hand hygiene compliance, which is the ultimate goal? Or actually, the ultimate goal would be to prevent infections. But at least, let's focus now on hand hygiene compliance. So what is the evidence that it works? Marianne already showed a table summarizing many of these data. But many of those studies have not been published so far. Slide 39. Few published studies have actually assessed the efficacy of these programs to improve hand hygiene compliance, and these have yielded discrepant results. So one of the key messages today is that we need more studies on the impact of those programs and published studies as well. Slide 40, this is a table that presents you 5 studies that have been published regarding the efficacy of those programs. 3 of them are from Marion. Actually, this is who just talked about those studies before. And let's focus now on the last line of this table. And you can see soap consumption. As Marion said, there's a denominator to these to the soap consumption, which is usually patient bed, for example. But you can see that the increase was not always significant. It was always an increase in consumption from 34% to 94%, but it was not always significant. In the study conducted in the UK, the 50% increase was not significant. And for the last two studies that I'm aware of that were published regarding its efficacy in the United States, more recently in 2008, actually there were no reports regarding the impact on hand hygiene itself. So we can see that actually hand hygiene compliance is much harder to evaluate when you're trying to assess the efficacy of these programs. Most of the time, people have focused on product consumption. So, slide 41. So, the few studies published so far suggest that soap consumption may increase. However, there's no data regarding actual hand hygiene compliance. And this data, as Marianne said, are from an era in which hand hygiene compliance was rather low. So, it is much easier to show increase in that situation. The question that everyone will wonder is, can these results be extended to settings in which are already using a multimodal strategy and which already have achieved a relatively high compliance rate? Would implementing a patient participation component increase it even further? This is a question that is still unanswered. I know some groups are working on that question, trying to answer this question, but they haven't published so far. So once more, I want to stress the fact that we need contemporary data. Slide 42, another question that might be interesting and that I've been wondering for a while is, why are there so few studies on this topic? Is it because of a lack of interest from the scientific community? That's one possibility. But there's always a question of publication bias. Publication bias, for those who are not familiar with this term, is the fact that studies that yield negative results are less likely to be published. So, and of course, studies that show incredible improvement and that are positive in their results are more likely to be published. But this is a question we might ask ourselves. Slide 43. So now let's focus a bit more on the patient aspect of this study. Slide 44. One question that sometimes I think we need to stop and ask ourselves is, what exactly are we asking patients to do? And this is what I asked the awkward factor. Slide 45, patients are reluctant to ask challenging questions. And slide 46, in a study that was published by Rachel Davies in the UK, she measured patients' willingness to ask different questions to their physician. And it was graded on a scale from 1 to 4. And she asked them 16 different questions. And some questions patients were highly willing to ask. For example, how long will I be in the hospital for? It scored 3.75 out of 4. So patients were highly likely to ask this question. However, on the other side, there were questions that were much less, for which patients were much less willing to ask. For example, how many times have you done this operation? Scored only 2.2 out of 4. And have you washed your hands? Scored only 2.0 out of 4. And actually, among the 16 questions, the one asking about hand hygiene had the lowest level of patient support. Slide 47. Many of you may be aware of the patient admission video that was created by the CDC. In case you haven't seen it, I encourage you to watch it. I've inserted the website in the bottom part of the slide. And today, sadly, I cannot present you the video itself, but I took two screenshots of the video. And in this video, these are scenarios that were thought out, that was very, which people were really careful to present patient intervention in a very favorable way. And on the left side, the screenshot on the left side, you can see a patient who is sleeping, and his wife is by his side, and the doctor is about to examine the patient, and the wife wants to intervene. So she's asking, and you see the subtitles here, "Doctor, I am embarrassed to even ask you this." So you see, even when you try to script the video itself, people acknowledge that it's a bit embarrassing to ask a question. And pay attention also to the body language. you can see the lady's hand, her right hand is she's extending her hand to block the healthcare worker before she touches her husband. And this body language is, in my mind, could be a bit embarrassing. If you look on the right side of this, the right side of the slide, you can see a second screenshot. In this screenshot, what you see is the doctor is telling the lady, don't worry, I've performed hand hygiene in the corridor before coming in, which is a very common answer you get from healthcare workers when patients ask this question. So the lady is telling the physician, please do it again in front of me. And she's pointing towards the hand drum dispenser. And this might lead to a bit of a confrontation. And I has been wondering for a long time, why is this potentially a confrontational situation? And I think that one of the reasons is that there's within the regular patient encounter, there's not a lot of room for patients to ask a question at the beginning of a physical exam. Doctors are in charge, or nurses are in charge of patient care, and they know they're about to examine the patient, and they will not ask them, I will now examine you. Do you have a question for me before examining you? So it'll always be an interruption. Slide 48. So the dynamics of patient encounter leaves little room to ask without interrupting. And in a study published in the BMJ, on average, doctors interrupted patient monologues after 21 seconds. So those healthcare workers are in charge. So if you want to ask this question and the healthcare worker does not leave a lot of room to ask the question, it will come at one point, it will come out as an interruption. Slide 49. Another question that you may ask yourself to answer the question, is it an awkward question we're asking, is would you do it if you were a patient yourself? So if yourself as a healthcare worker were in a position in which you and you become a patient yourself, would you ask the question? Slide 50. And so Didier Pitet asked these questions in his study in the UK. So he asked people, would you yourself ask about hand hygiene if you were a patient? And 37% only said that they would ask a nurse, and 29% said that they would ask a doctor. So it seems to me that it's not something that is completely accepted so far. Slide 51, do patients ask themselves? Do they ask? So slide 52, we go back to the previous table, and we can now focus on the first two lines. Did you ask a nurse and did you ask a physician? And these are the same data that Marion presented, so I'll try to present the glass as half empty instead of half full, but it's basically the same glass, the same data. So, yes, 90% of people said that they did ask a nurse, but in the first three studies, a bit lower rate, though, in the United States, the most recent studies. And did you ask a physician was systematically lower than nurses all across the studies, down to 30% only, approximately. And this is a self-reported patient intervention rate for the overall hospitalization. So we can imagine that there's probably 10 encounters per day. Someone stays in the hospital for 5 days. It will be 50 encounters. And this is 90% of people reported asking at least once. But we don't really have a rate of asking in terms of per patient encounter. We don't really have this data so far. So the next slide. So the difference in willingness to ask, in my opinion, is highly suggestive of some degree of uneasiness. Slide 54. So now let's focus now a bit on how do patients feel about asking. Slide 55. We conducted a study in Geneva, overall we had some pretty positive results. 80% of patients had heard about healthcare-associated infections. 39% had identified hand hygiene as the most important preventive measure. And 66% believe that healthcare workers should perform hand hygiene prior to shaking hands. Next slide, 56. However, two-thirds would not feel comfortable to ask healthcare workers to clean their hands. Slide 57. So the reasons that that patients provided for not intending to ask were the following. First, the belief that caregivers should know or already know the indications. There's a belief that this task is not part of the patient's role. Third, there's a feeling that it would be embarrassing or awkward to ask a question. There's a fear of reprisals that was there for among 11% of responders, and a perception of being impolite or disrespectful. Slide 58, so it seems that not only healthcare workers still hold a paternalistic vision of their relationship with patients, it seems also that patients themselves have a paternalistic vision of their relationship. So this means that there'll have to be a lot of convincing to do. And one of the questions some people might ask themselves in an era of limited resources is, do we have the required resources to invest in convincing the patients that they can ask the questions? Because this is a matter of energy. People need to convince patients that they can change their vision of their relationship with the healthcare worker. Slide 59. There are also a few unanswered questions in my mind. First, can it generate anxiety in a patient who is told that he should make sure that healthcare worker wash their hands, but who does not dare asking, and who then subsequently witness hand hygiene omission? So he sees the healthcare worker come, does not perform hand hygiene, takes care of him or her, but he doesn't dare asking. Would this create anxiety in the patient? This is a valid question that will need to be answered one day. And the second question, which is a consequence of the first one, actually, is would this transfer part of the responsibility to the patient? Let's say a patient does not ensure that the healthcare worker performs hand hygiene before taking care of him and subsequently acquires an infection. Would he be responsible for the infection to some extent because he didn't do everything he could to prevent it? This could be like a rhetorical question, but some healthcare workers will ask themselves this question. So we should focus on it and try to answer this question. Slide 60. Now let's focus on the healthcare workers' side, because as Marianne mentioned very well, healthcare workers need to be involved as well. They need to accept the concept if you want empowerment to occur. Slide 61. So their support is central to the success of patient participation endeavors, and failure to enlist their open support may undermine the outcome of such programs. Slide 62. So what are healthcare workers' perception of these programs? Slide 63. We performed a study in Geneva recently. It was published recently last fall to assess healthcare workers' views of these programs. And we even include some taboo questions that you'll see in the following slides. We got a pretty decent response rate of 41%, which I think we can be proud of, considering that many physicians were involved, and physicians really usually don't like to answer surveys. It was a mailed-in survey. Slide 64. So first, two-thirds of healthcare workers had a favorable view of a potential intervention of patients regarding hand hygiene omission. So most of them said that if a patient notices that they forgot to perform hand hygiene, they would appreciate that he or she reminds them to perform hand hygiene. So that was a very encouraging result. On slide 65, also approximately a bit more than half of respondents said that they would accept to wear a badge inviting patients to ask about hand hygiene. And this is very important. Marianne mentioned it herself. Because on slide 66, you can see that explicit invitation really increases significantly a patient's willingness to ask the question. Slide 67. But then we dug a little bit deeper into healthcare workers' feelings and beliefs. And I think that some of these feelings will need to be addressed in the future. On slide 68, you can see that in our survey, 17% of healthcare workers thought that patient inquiry about hand hygiene would be upsetting. Slide 69, 27% thought it could be humiliating for them to be reminded by a patient to clean their hands. On slide 70, 43% said they would feel ashamed to admit that they forgot to clean their hands. On slide 71, 44% would feel guilty if a patient discovered that they forgot to perform hand hygiene. On slide 72, patients may become angry. Half of respondents fear that patients could become angry if they detected that they forgot to perform hand hygiene. And this result was also, on slide 73, was also a similar result was obtained by Pittet in his study in the UK. In this study, 25% of healthcare workers feared that it could create tension between healthcare workers and patients. On slide 74, we have a little cartoon here that it's almost as if healthcare workers could really be afraid that such program could backlash and create some patient dissatisfaction. On slide 74, we go back to the study we performed in Geneva. This is something that is interesting. Nevertheless, we see that most healthcare workers feel that despite all the negative feelings, they think that such program could improve staff hand hygiene compliance. A bit as if the potential of patient anger or backlash could elevate the healthcare worker to become a better healthcare worker. On slide 76, so healthcare workers, many of them don't like the idea of being asked, but yet many think also that it would help improve their hand hygiene behavior. So this could be surprising a little bit at first. And we have many different hypotheses regarding this to explain this situation. On slide 77, I think that one explanation is that patient participation program could improve hand hygiene compliance through different mechanisms. But this hypothesis has not been verified so far. On slide 78, I created a hypothetical patient participation program, the red arrow, which would have as a consequence, happy consequence, of improving hand hygiene compliance, which is on the y-axis as time evolves. And we can think of three different ways through which these programs could improve hand hygiene. First, there's a simple fact that conducting a program like this in your hospital will increase healthcare worker awareness. It will be a form of education. You will tell your healthcare workers hand hygiene is so important that we even want patients to be involved. So only this could improve hand hygiene compliance by itself. Second one, there's a normative pressure. Healthcare workers may start performing hand hygiene because now they know that patients, well, actually, this is empowerment. It's exactly what Marianne is talking about, empowerment. Because they know that patients are aware of hand hygiene indications and they don't want to be asked. They want to look professional. They want to look competent. So they will perform hand hygiene accordingly. And the third one will be direct patient intervention, in which really a healthcare worker comes up to a patient, does not perform hand hygiene, and a patient intervenes, asks the question. That would be the third way. So these are the three different mechanisms we can think of. On slide 79, so the efficacy of such campaign cannot be assessed solely by measuring the proportion of patients who ask about hand hygiene, because the ultimate goal is to increase hand hygiene compliance. It is not to achieve high rates of patient intervention. But this hypothesis has not been verified so far. So this is why we'll need more studies to better understand the mechanisms through which patient empowerment works. On slide 80, I have this very bad analogy of silent empowerment. We can easily imagine that drivers tend to respect the speed limit in order to avoid the unpleasant situation of getting a speeding ticket. And in a similar way, on slide 81, healthcare workers are probably more likely to perform hand hygiene in order to avoid the unpleasant situation of being asked by a patient and having to say, oh, thank you, I forgot. Now I feel ashamed, I feel humiliated. But this has not been verified so far, so we need more studies to better understand how it works. On slide 82, there's even some indirect evidence of silent power of patients. First, there was a study conducted by Julian in which they have shown that a single patient intervention can induce a long-lasting change in healthcare worker behavior. In this study, 81% of healthcare workers who had been reminded to perform hand hygiene by a patient were subsequently very much more careful about it during subsequent care activities. So a single patient who asked could have an impact, a long-lasting effect on the healthcare worker. So in conclusion, if we take all these things, and I'm trying to present the cons side on slide 84, I think that patient participation, patient empowerment, is a very promising avenue to improve staff and hygiene compliance. However, I think that many patients and healthcare workers are not comfortable with such programs, and no clear solution has been found so far to overcome this obstacle. And in an era of limited resources, we have to ask ourselves, do we have the required resources to spend on convincing and making both healthcare workers and patients comfortable with this program? And many questions remain to be answered. First, regarding the efficacy of these programs to improve hand hygiene compliance, and also to assess the relative contribution of silent empowerment and normative pressure as well, not only the proportion of patients who ask. Slide 85. So for all these reasons, I believe that we cannot say that these programs work yet. So that was an impatient, that was my speech. Now I give the microphone back to Marianne to conclude.
Thank you, Eve. As I proceed now to talk about giving you the tips for implementation, let me first say, when I put on my research hat, I fully agree where Eve is coming from, that yes, we do need more studies to look at some of these issues. And I think in particular, remember, we talked about the bell curve, and I think the work that Eve is going to be doing and others along those lines will bring in the two sides of the bell curve. With my experience of having educated many patients and where consumers are right now, I believe that we have an obligation to go after the middle part of that bell curve from what we know, and there is there are resources out there to do that. So what I'd like to do is go through these six simple steps that you can use and you can start tomorrow to get your patients involved. And these have been tested. When I say tested, we've been out there educating and getting patient empowerment programs going in many healthcare facilities, both here and abroad. So the six phases are, number one, gather your facts. What we did for you here is really put together what we consider four important resources that you need to look at when you begin your patient empowerment program. First, the guidelines. Secondly, we put an article together, the team that worked on the guidelines for patient involvement. We did an article that was in the American Journal of Medical Quality. And in that article, we summarized a lot of the information in the guidelines and gave a working document on how you can empower your patients. The third that we're excited about, and it will be online shortly, probably within the next month, is we did an update and we looked at patient empowerment since the World Health Organization guidelines, a review. Patient empowerment and hand hygiene from 1997 to 2012, and it will be in the Journal of Hospital Infection Control, and it should be online shortly with the hard copy coming to follow. And then, of course, the WHO website just has wonderful resources. So the first step that you're going to start tomorrow, I hope you're all going to start this tomorrow, is start to gather your facts, because you're going to need this information when you go to step two, which is meet with your leaders. Everyone in your institution has a role, so therefore you do have resources. You just haven't tapped into them, and I'll explain that to you shortly. The first thing you need to do is meet with your key decision makers. A program like this is not going to work unless you have support from the top down. You want your key people to buy into this, and people, the infection control practitioner is the person that's going to drive this. You need to go into these key decision makers with an agenda. No more than 30 minutes. Have your background information. Use any of the slides that you've seen today on this PowerPoint presentation talking about where people have used empowerment. The next thing you need to do is choose two pilot sites. So you want to begin small, something that's manageable and not intensive care units. Often health care workers want to start in their intensive care units, and that's not the place to start with a patient empowerment model. The next thing you want to do is meet with your nurse managers, and they are going to be vital to this program, because often they are the ones that are going to express the concerns that Eve talked about, like, are we giving too much to the patient to do? Is it awkward? So you need to spend time reassuring them how this program and making sure that they see themselves as leaders in this program. The next important thing that I think can alleviate a lot of the awkwardness of programs such as Empowerment is to make sure that you have a consumer. Many hospitals in the U.S., I know, have consumer patient advisory committees or even members of their community. You want to pull some of these people in to be part of the leaders in developing your program. The third step, advocates for patient empowerment. And I really say that, you know, we have 2 months between now and May 5th in order to really bump up the number of people that are using patient empowerment. And I think steps 1, 2, and 3 are something that are attainable between now and the global challenge on May 5th. So how are you going to identify your helpers? You need champions. You need helpers. And what we advocate is that for your pilot unit team, where you're going to do your initial study, you want to organize or block out 1 to 3 sessions in which you're going to introduce these healthcare workers to the whole idea of patient empowerment. We highly recommend that you use the concept or the theory of positive deviance. Now, this has been, positive deviance has many steps, and I always like to tell people, it's like going to the salad bar. You're going to pick and choose those things that work best for you. Not all of the phases you may want to use, but I can tell you that when you use positive deviance, you will quickly see when you gather all the healthcare workers from the 2 units, you will see those that will be your champions. And hopefully they're going to be in the ones in the middle of that bell curve. They're going to rally around you. You're going to see the ones that are going to surface. And the ones on either end of the bell curve, you know, there's probably not a lot you're going to do to convert them. But by example, they will gradually come along to be part of this program. Positive Deviance on their website, which I have here, has wonderful free seminars that you can download and look at. They actually have a good example of how it's done with MRSA. So I suggest that you look at this, and this will help you identify advocates. So by May 5th, you should be able to be at the point to say, I've met with my key decision makers. I have my advocates to go. The fourth one is you have options. There are many resources out there. When we started doing this in 1997, we had to develop our own materials. But now there are many posters, videos that you can use. And it's a matter of you choosing what the theme of your program is going to be. And you want to do this along with your nurse managers and along with your team. So you want to order your brochures, make sure you decide what visual reminders you want to use. And remember, you need to get input from the consumer out there, from your community. We do know one important thing, that research has shown that patients prefer printed materials and that they have their own visual reminder. So do not consider a poster a visual reminder. You want to use something like a hand sanitizer or a button or something that they can relate to. Slide number 91, explicit permission. Now, here's where I think we often get lost, and Eve has addressed the issue of, you know, a lot of time and resources. I can tell you over the last 10 years where we've trained hundreds of people on this methodology, it's really very gratifying to see the number of ways that infection control people can come up with giving explicit permission to patients. And that's important. So in step number 5, you want to determine distribution. That is distribution of materials to the patient on a one-to-one basis. And what you need to consider, first of all, is how is this going to be done for emergent admissions and for non-emergent patients. Some of the suggestions that I put here is we've had sites that have used the nurse at the time of nursing assessment when someone is admitted. They have used licensed practical nurses, volunteers, students, admission staff, patient advocates, intranet, and hospital patient videos. We have a whole list of different ways in which people have used this. And the key thing is we are not in any way advocating that the infection control practitioner is the person that needs to do this. In fact, myself having been one of those practitioners in years past, I do not design a program that's going to put more work on the practitioner. We do have one practitioner that I think is an ideal role model, and if someone can, people can do this in their hospital, it really makes this process easier. And what she did was, it was actually an 800-bed hospital, And she wanted to roll out this program through the entire hospital, which we don't advocate, but she suggested that she wanted everyone to do this at the same time. And in that institution, healthcare facility, what they have is they have a very active environmental service department, or also known as housekeeping. And what they do on a daily basis, they have someone from their housekeeping team visits every patient's room on a daily basis and basically asks them about environmental issues, like, is your room clean? Do you have any problems? Well, she identified these individuals as her key champions to move this program. So every day when they finish their questions to the patients about the environmental aspects of the room, they then said, we now have a program about patient empowerment or involvement, and gives the materials and says, we encourage you to do this and ask your healthcare worker. I think it's an ingenious way to get people from other departments involved and move the program forward. Slide number 92 is the evaluation and the measurement. If you're going to start this program, you have to have a way of measuring. Now, again, when we started this program, we did not change anything in people's hand hygiene programs. They went along with what they were doing, and the only variable that we introduced was the patient. However, now with the WHO guidelines that advocate a multimodal hand hygiene program, that's the first thing that you need to do. We encourage you to make sure that you have all of the components in your program. Then establish a hand hygiene measurement process. I'm not going to get into what you should be doing, how you should be doing the debates between product consumption and observation, but I can tell you in the initial steps, if you're trying to do a pre and a post intervention type study in a short period of time, it's much easier for you to look at hand hygiene compliance per bed day so that you have some good data after, say, a three-month period. Then you want to develop a simple five-question patient survey. We did this in the very beginning where at the time, when our initial studies, we actually called the patients after they were discharged because we were doing groundwork along this process. Now we suggest that the discharge nurse, which is an important factor in hospitalizations right now because of the issue of readmissions, we want to make sure that patients have a clear idea of what they're to do when they're discharged. So we have this questionnaire, just five questions about hand hygiene activity, the patient being invited to ask, and did they ask anyone, and you want to evaluate the results. The final thing is what we call our 12-step checklist. You know, I suggest after this presentation you print this out or carry this around. And there are 12 steps here that go through everything that we just spoke about and a checklist on what you need to do. And you should be able to get to the point of at least developing champions by our May 5th Global Challenge. And I'm very optimistic. You know, I go with the glass, you know, mostly full, in that when you do these steps, you will be able to involve those 60% or 70% that are in the middle of the bell curve, and you need to celebrate. I'd like to thank the World Health Organization for allowing Eve and I to present this important topic, and I'd like to thank one of my associates, our education director, Mr. John Govednik, for helping in the implementation. He was vital in educating many of our ICPs out there. And please feel free to contact either of us. Our websites are listed. And again, I'll turn this back over to Claire, and we'd like to thank you for this opportunity.
Dr. McGuckin, this is Paul Weber. I got an email from Claire that her flight was about to leave and she had to hang up. So,
okay.
I'll close the comment. Thank you very much for this. It's been a very valuable time. And Eve, thank you very much for taking the position in opposition, or the con position. That's a big challenge. Certainly it's a risk because everyone sees patient-stimulated hand hygiene as sort of the holy grail, is what we should be going for. But it's, as you pointed out, it isn't necessarily that way if it's not done right. And Dr. McGuckin, thank you for pointing out how it could be right and for laying out the groundwork of how to approach that. The next slide is a list of the WHO teleclasses that are pending for all of the year. These are all free registration, and if you can join them live, great. If you can't join them live, you still have access to the online recordings. So lastly, I would like to thank our two speakers for giving a tremendous presentation. The audience for this teleclass is one of our largest ever, and in fact, as I mentioned before the teleclass, the registrations actually crashed our server because there were so many coming in all at once. So that's a good sign, and I thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back again. And to all of you who have joined the teleclass and registered for it, thank you as well. This program is run entirely by volunteers and on a not-for-profit basis, so you sure make it easy, and I thank you for participating. To all, I will say goodbye, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.